For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
We've been talking about joy, and joy really from three perspectives. One is just the content, the substance of joy, which is a delight, a sense of fullness in our hearts that we have, and that the Bible describes joy in a lot of different ways. The joy when something that is incredibly valuable to us has been lost and now we find it. A relationship that has been severed and now it's been reconciled. And just that deep sense of connection that we have with things that matter and the people who matter. That's what joy is, the deeply fulfilling, satisfying inner sense. We've talked about the foundation of joy, the joy of the Lord. That joy is really something that is a gift of God to people. And we're going to really finish next week really exploring that in a great deal of depth. And then thirdly, there's the expression of joy, rejoicing, as Paul says here in chapter 4, verse 10. The idea that to experience joy, it is important that we express joy. And that in expressing a sense of gratitude, a sense of connection with the things that God has built into our lives, that opens the door to a broader and deeper experience of joy as well. And so we want to explore this morning Paul's concluding paragraph where he says, I rejoice in the Lord greatly. Just expressing his deep, heartfelt appreciation for the relationship that God gave to him with the Philippians, the things that God was doing in his life through that relationship. And he says, I rejoice greatly in the Lord that now at last you revived your concern for me. You were concerned before, but you lacked opportunity to help. The Philippian church was deeply a poor church. They were unable for a significant amount of time to provide what they really wanted to provide for Paul, which is financial resources while he's in prison, so that he could move out of a cell and into an apartment under the guard of the Roman Praetorians, and a friend to be with him, a guy named Epaphroditus. But now finally, they've gotten it together, they've been able to do that, and this letter is really a response an expression of joy to God for this great gift that they gave Paul. And then he goes on and he says, not that I speak from want, for I have learned to be content in whatever circumstance I am. I know how to get along with humble means. I also know how to live in prosperity. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, both of having abundance and suffering need. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. And this is the paragraph that we want to dive into a little bit here this morning. The focus is verse 11, not that I speak from one, he says, but I've learned to be content in whatever circumstance I am. Wow. Really need to unpack this just a little bit. What Paul is saying here is really quite amazing. Contentment. It's like being that lion laying on your back. Satisfied with all that gazelle in my stomach. An abundance, enough, full. That's what contentment is. And Paul says, I'm like a lion on his back. Just feeling like I don't need anything else. I'm just totally filled. And that's pretty amazing when you think about the circumstances, of course, that he's in. And it seems to me as well that in our culture, that the idea of contentment is something that is really quite elusive and ironic also in the same way. You think about our society, modern West, America in particular, with incredible affluence that is shared by such a broad swath of our society. There's very little that we really need that we don't have immediately at our disposal, that whatever we need and a lot of what we want is just there for us. And yet, it's interesting that social scientists tell us that American society in general is really experiencing a crisis of happiness, as they say. And there is actually a whole field of sociological research into the question of happiness. And their point is that essentially Americans, though we are historical in the dimensions and extent of our affluence, are also more miserable than we've ever been. And so we think about that from the standpoint of what Paul is writing here in this deprived place in prison, waiting for a trial that may end in his execution. And he's like, I'm totally content. I'm satisfied. You think about that. In our day, there is just a kind of a stoic resignation that we have in the face of the problems that we have because we can't be content. And the reality is that even though we are remarkably affluent, and certainly relative to pretty much the rest of the world, there are things that money just can't buy. We can't buy our way into effective, satisfying relationships. Can't do it. We can't buy our way out of physical discomfort, the certainty of a declining body and ultimately death. There are so many things that really give rise to deep contentment in life that cannot be measured in financial terms. And so we, as a society, for many of us, just kind of resolve in an inwardly bitter way, really, to just grit our teeth and go on and make life as comfortable as we possibly can. But that's so far removed from the idea of contentment, a fullness, a plenty of this is enough, I'm satisfied. And similarly, we think of the people who have just kind of settled for way less. And who no longer really have much ambition at all. And is that really what we're talking about by contentment, the absence of desire? That just seems like completely not that way at all. What could be less humanly fulfilling than just to not care anymore about developing the strengths that we have, of entering into victorious relationships, of living a way of life that is ultimately meaningful and purposeful? And yet, you know, that is the way that many of us in our society have kind of moved, is toward a distracted world of just kind of settling for what's right in front of me. If I can be distracted long enough, I can get through the day and go to bed at night and realizing that tomorrow's going to look pretty much like today did. And so there is, you know, for a lot of us in our culture, that's the way we're more or less living. We try not to ask the difficult questions, the important questions, indeed the human questions, anymore, because we've just settled in our minds that what life is really all about is more or less just kind of surviving from day to day. There are other elements of our society that affect this whole question of contentment as well. We live, as you know, in a consumer society, and there's a basic assumption in consumerism, which is that you need to be discontent. And so we sell discontent in order to sell satisfaction. And so we need to learn that your life completely sucks unless you buy this product that you did not even know yesterday existed, but now which is the key to life. And if you just watch carefully the way that we are molded into focusing our desires, you know, playing to our insecurities. If you don't have this product, you know, you should just live in constant fear of what might happen next. Buy this diet and you'll go, you'll be this, go from some undesirable person to this person that is just, you know, should be all over the cover of a magazine or whatever. Discontent as a way of life produces the interest in buying more things to get out of this problem. Last summer, our son got married, and he and his wife, she's European, and there are people from all over the world there. And we were sitting at the reception, and my phone rang. And I answered my phone, And the lady sitting next to me said, "What is that?" I said, "That's a telephone." She said, "Oh, I know what it is. The point I'm trying to make is, why do you have this thing? That's so 2015. You know, and as everyone's sitting around with their smartphones, staring at a screen instead of the person, you know, across the table from them. And you just begin to realize it's possible to have this incredible, nearly miraculous device that you can pull out of your pocket and actually talk to somebody who's way far in another country even. Think about how significant that is. And then to set it down for someone to say, "That's just trash. I can't believe that you're satisfied with that." And so the discontent that is intentionally bred within us is there to tell us, if you just have more, if you just buy this. And so there is a way to kind of rewire our brain so that we become these consumer sapiens that are always living for the next material conquest. And that is why, to a large extent, and what we sacrifice for being that way, that people have argued that we are in both the most affluent and the most discontented culture that there has ever been. And then at the same time, too, there is this question, not are we content, but should we be content? And so each generation, I think, there arises a certain kind of counterculture. It's, you know, it's trying to say that we shouldn't be going with the flow here, and there's a better way, and so forth. And I grew up with that kind of countercultural influence in the 1960s and the early 1970s, the turn on, tune in, drop out message of the counterculture, which was extremely destructive, of course. But they did get something right, which is namely the willingness to ask this deeper question of, is the direction that our culture is pushing us, is that really what we need? Is that really ultimately satisfying? And I think for that reason and that reason alone, it is important to really listen to those who are kind of working outside the cultural mainstream, because they sometimes shed some real light in there for the rest of us. Should we, in fact, be content? Is being content a goal that we ought to pursue? I was thinking about this in relationship to Abraham. In the Old Testament, Abraham was given a promise that God would grant him the land of Canaan, which becomes Israel, that he would make from him a great nation. And then for decades, Abraham spent his life touring around this land that was on the one hand his and on the one hand belonged to other people, realizing that the fulfillment of this promise really lay in the distant future. And so the author of Hebrews, in commenting on what's going on in the mind of Abraham, puts it like this. He says, "By faith, Abraham lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents. For it says he was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God." And that really, that's in this chapter, Hebrews chapter 11, that are full of illustrations of the life of faith. And what he is basically saying here is that while on the one hand, Abraham was given this incredible promise, at the other end is the fact that the completion of that promise lay in the distant future, and that Abraham's call was to live in hope. "This world is not my home. I'm just a passing through," a song we used to sing back in the 70s. And that really is true, that in a certain important sense, we should not be content in this world, because this world does not provide for us the things that really give rise to the soul contentment, that give rise to the kind of joy that God intends for you as his children. So let's just plumb into the depths of our paragraph here a little bit this morning and look at three things that Paul unfolds to show what is the real sense, the meaning of contentment. And how does that connect with joy? He says, first, that contentment is something that is learned. It's not natural for us to be content. Anyone who has had a baby knows babies are not contented, right? You know, and they're just like an alarm clock every hour or so, beckoning you to meet their every need. But we learn over time to help build a sense of contentment into our child, we hope. Paul says, not that I speak from want, for I have learned to be content. Some of us are slow learners, like me. And what does it mean then to develop, to cultivate this skill in life where we are able to be, as Paul says, content in whatever circumstance I am? Well, let's think about that just a little bit. Part of it, and we can see all of these points from the letter, is rooted in the practice of gratitude. And so Paul can say to his friends, I thank my God in all my remembrance of you. And it is the grateful heart, the one who that takes joy in whatever is given to them, that builds this sense of real contentment in the presence. A grateful heart is content because it's easy to please. And so we might want to ask ourselves this morning, am I high maintenance or low maintenance? Am I hard to satisfy or am I easy to satisfy? And I think that, you know, for a lot of us, we just kind of live in a state of chronic disappointment because we're so hard to please that, you know, we receive things from people and it's like, oh, that's great, but it's not quite enough. It's not quite the right thing or in the right kind of way or whatever it is. And there's always this kind of ongoing feeling that it's just not quite enough. But a grateful heart, one that just appreciates deeply not only what's given, but the heart and the spirit behind the gift, is easy to please. And so when a person is like this, they're content. And a contented heart is a joyous heart because it's full. And so one of the things that we really just maybe don't even need to think anything beyond this one point here this morning is that lingering sense of discontent that greets us in the morning when we think about the day ahead, when we think about the disappointments of the day before or whatever, may be far more rooted not in what's actually going on in life, but is actually a reflection of what's going on in my own heart. And that indeed, it's that lack of a sense of gratitude, a lack of a sense that nobody owes me anything, and yet I continue to receive. And that unmerited generosity that comes from the people in my life, either I'll become grateful and my heart will be shaped by that, or I'll be blind to the mercy and just develop a life of expectations that are never met. And I just want to urge all of us here today that as we engage life, that we consciously and multiple times throughout the day just stop for a second and express gratitude to God, to the circumstances of life, whatever they may be, and to the people who are in our life, that these are all undeserved gifts. And that if we cannot see life through that lens, then we will never really enjoy the level of contentment that God intends to bring to us. Many of us, we have such a habit of expectation that there is no place for gratitude. And because there's no place for gratitude, there's no place for feeling full, for feeling that it's enough. And so we just go on with that ongoing feeling of this elusive quest for maybe when I'm in the future, maybe some things will come through for me or whatever. I remember when we had young children, those many, many, many years ago. And just thinking, you know, this is so hard. They're screaming. Our daughter screams so frequently and so loud at night, we sleep with a pillow over our ears, just hoping that she would somehow wear herself out and go to sleep. And the thought was, you know, but she'll be a toddler soon, and this day will go by. And then she became a toddler, and oh my God. It's embarrassing to say, but I'll say it. My daughter's first word that she spoke with clarity beyond the kind of babble of mama and dada was self. We'd try to feed her, and she'd grab my hand, and she's going, self, self. She wanted to feed herself. And so she just is very strong-willed girl, and we're like, well, at least she'll grow up, you know. And we were always thinking about what happens next. Thinking, well, when they're in high school, you know, they'll be more independent, which unfortunately they were, you know. Always, you know, when in the future, looking for circumstances that will somehow make life easier and therefore more contented. And just realizing at a certain point, wait a minute, today is tomorrow. This is the moment that we have to experience gratitude for all that God has brought to us. And when we began realizing that it's in the here and the now, not in the hope of tomorrow, that we began to really develop, you know, in our family, a deeper sense of true contentment and a joy with all of its imperfections in the moment. And I just think that sometimes we lose that sense in the busyness and in the complexity of the lives that we have. A contented heart is a joyous heart because it's full. Are you full this morning? Are you full? Connect that with the things that you are deeply grateful for and the mercy that underlies those gifts that you have received. Second, there is this issue of delayed gratification. You know, Paul's in prison. It's not a pleasant situation that he finds himself in. He's able to rejoice in that situation, but not for that situation. But the reality is that there is something in the future that enables him to live in the present. And so he says, forgetting what lies behind. This is chapter 3. We read this a couple of weeks ago. Forgetting what lies behind and reaching forward to what lies ahead, I press on toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. Look at that forward-looking emphasis here, that upward call, that reaching forward, that Paul is looking at his present in the light of his future, in the light of where things are going. He is a person of hope and discontent. This is the important point. Breeds in a swamp while contentment flourishes in the stream. How does your life smell this morning? Is it swampy? Are you sitting there just waiting for things to improve for you, to change, so that you can go from discontent to content? My friend, a swamp, because it never moves, never changes. It just gets, well, stankier. But if we, like Paul, have this forward-looking, pressing forward kind of attitude about life, God's involved, there is a future, and as I set my sights on those things that God has called me to accomplish, as I set my sights on what does it mean to really move toward the things that God has for me in this world, in this life, the service that he's called me to, then all of a sudden the burden of being fulfilled lessens. Because why? Because now the focus is out there. And as it lessens, because what we see is the goal toward which we are striving, it eases the pressure, and we begin to feel the very thing that we recognize that we lack to begin with. I think probably the greatest window or picture of this is the athlete. An athlete can go through a lot of exhaustion. Are you tired this morning? Not tired like an athlete can be tired. Are you in pain? Are you sore? Well, you know, an athlete who's shaped by competition knows exactly what it feels like to wake up achy and in pain, overcoming injuries and so forth. But there is something about that goal-focusedness of the athlete that enables them to feel a deep sense that of contentment as they move forward, because they know that whatever discomfort they're experiencing in the present is helping to shape and mold them towards something greater in the future. And so that future orientation is our birthright as believers in Jesus Christ. We have a future. We know how this story ends. And as we sit in a single-minded way, pursue the things of God, it just enables us, the encumbrances, the things that hold us back, just begin to feel lighter for us as more tangibly we begin to sense and experience the future that God is bringing us to. But contentment means that we are following, that we are reaching, as he says, toward the future, and not just sitting idly by waiting for things to change for us, or for our negative feelings to be salved in some way. It's just not going to happen for us. We've got to keep moving. That's why the Christian life is called a walk. And then, two, there is this outward focus on other people that is really a key to experiencing contentment in life. Paul puts it like this. He says, not that I seek the gift which was given to them by the Philippians, he says, but I seek the profit which it increases to your account. What really excites me about this generosity that you've shown is not that my life hangs in the balance of whether I receive it or not, but what it represents in terms of the bond that we enjoy between each other. The relational element of this thing, that's what really matters. There's a vulnerability that comes in receiving. And you know, for Paul to say, you know, I don't need anything from you, I'm just fine, in some ways, I suppose, might be true. But it's a real way to kill a relationship. And relationships develop, and a real sense of contentment occurs because of that when we allow people to meet needs in our life, even needs that perhaps we would be able to meet on our own. It's just the act of opening our heart and receiving the generosity from other people that enables us to form these bonds with others. And for a lot of us, it's just our pride that gets in the way. I was talking about this some last week in the example of my tortured kitchen project that went over a decade before I was able to wash my hands of it and have somebody fix it. Why was I like that? Why did I endure 10 years of the stupidest looking kitchen ever? The subtle ridicule of all our friends, and we're still our children's friends. Because I'm really that proud. That's really why. Just like a whole bunch of you. Am I right? And so we've got to project that it's all under control. Yeah, that's true. I'll serve you, but I don't need from you. And just, you know, the reality is that that's just a real stiff-necked pride. And it just says basically that I'm too important, you know, you don't have to worry about me. And so just that arm's length living is just so empty and so unfulfilling. When everybody's contribution truly matters, now we begin to experience the richness of Christian community. That's when it really matters. When I allow myself to be vulnerable to other people, connecting and meeting needs in my life, as counterintuitive as that is to my own self-reliant tendency, it enables me to feel a sense of closeness to the people who are around me, and therefore opens the door to something richer and more beautiful in our relationship. So contentment is something that doesn't come naturally to us. is something that we learn, and we learn it through gratitude. We learn it by delaying gratification, experiencing difficulty in the present for the sake of the future reward, and it is rooted deeply in our relationships with other people. Secondly, it is not circumstance dependent. That's the most obvious thing from this paragraph that Paul can talk about his being content and regardless of the circumstances he's in. I know, he says, how to get along. With humble means, how to live in prosperity. In every and any and every circumstance, I've learned the secret of being filled, of being hungry, of having an abundance, of suffering need. It's that he's got something going on in his heart that the external world really cannot affect. It's an amazing thing. Americans are massive controllers. We want to shape and protect and guide anything that might influence our happiness, right? I'm that way. I know you are too. And we've got oftentimes the resources to kind of control our life and to avoid unpleasant circumstances to the highest degree possible and pursue those things that are pleasurable. We're massive controllers, but like we said at the beginning, we can't control everything, and inevitably reality is going to come crashing in upon us. We really need to find a place for contentment that exists irrespective of the circumstances that we find ourselves in. And so some of you here this morning are coming from a really hard place. I know that's true because I interact with so many of you here this morning and in other venues like it. I know that some of you are struggling because you don't really have enough to continue to make rent every month and to feed your families. Some of us are really struggling with the deterioration of our body and some of it the burden of just feeling like I've mistreated myself for so long. And so there's not only the discomfort of a deteriorating body, but also a sense of guilt like I've brought this upon myself. We've got all kinds of relational disconnects. We're alienated from our kids. We wonder, you know, what's going on in our marriage, if we even have that at this point. Maybe we're divorced. And we're just wondering, is there anything that enables, will allow me to have a sense of contentment given the broken person that I am and the broken world in which I live? And Paul, I think, comes to this thing in a real helpful way, because contentment and circumstances need not be the same thing at all. And here, and just thinking about poverty as kind of an illustration of circumstantial things that might give rise to a lack of contentment, just thinking about the gift that many of our partners around the world through this fellowship show us as they live oftentimes in extreme poverty and significant levels of poverty, and yet so often demonstrate to us a level of contentment and joy that many of us here just have no category for at all. What is poverty? Poverty, yes, is a lack of resources. That's right. And so it's possible to feel really depleted because, we don't have what it takes. I remember traveling in Haiti right after the earthquake in 2010. An ocean of over a million people in the city of Port-au-Prince living in tents, like Boy Scout tents, and not knowing where the next meal would be coming from, not having running water, not having a job to go to that day. And that chronic lack of resources keeps people in deep poverty, but that's not the end of the story, because poverty is more than the lack of resources. Poverty is also a lack of community. That it is the quality of community interaction. It's the quality of how we look toward one another that really shapes our understanding of what poverty is. It was astounding to me to see in those tent communities, those years ago now, how a person would bring in children whose parents had died in the earthquake, and they didn't even know these kids. But now they're a part of our tent. and they didn't know where their next meal was coming from, but the person in the tent next to them had a little bit of extra rice that day to share with them. And so it was that the community sort of had each other's back. They cared for one another. So were they poor? Yes. But they were also rich in community. They were watching out for one another. Poverty is a lack of relational capacity. That's right. That poverty occurs when I no longer know how to function effectively in relationship to other people. And so it's possible to have all kinds of wealth, but have such depth of soul because of my lack of ability to have true relational success that I never really experience the fullness of what my possessions bring to me. And lastly, that poverty is at its core a lack of spiritual reality. When we think about contentment, we must never think in the crass material terms that is often presented to us, is that as long as we have enough stuff, that somehow we'll feel contentment. No, contentment comes when all of these areas together are truly met. And for this reason, and with the last one in mind, that there is something deep within us spiritually that has to be met for us to experience true contentment, that Paul talks about contentment as a secret. He says, you know, you can be broke, but not poor. That's right. You can be wealthy, but not rich. We have a lot of people in our culture today who have a lot of money and who are desperately poor. And we have a lot of people as well who have no money, but who are rich within. And I remember that years ago when my wife and I moved to Chicago to go to school. And we didn't have two nickels to rub together at all. But God always provided for us. We never borrowed a dime. We always had enough to meet our needs, even though we didn't necessarily know from month to month where that was going to come from. And we look back at that era of our life as really a defining moment for us, where we learned something profound, which was that it didn't matter what our circumstances were. We could be as broke as could be, but as long as we had a deep connection with each other, a community that we were becoming a part of, something meaningful to do with our lives, that we were as rich as could be. And I wouldn't trade those days for anything. But there is, as Paul says, a secret to contentment. He says, I've learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, both of having an abundance and suffering need. What's the secret? The secret is this. Verse 13, the very next sentence, he says, I can do all things through him who strengthens me. The secret to real contentment is this. Contentment is not attained by a method, but in relationship with Christ. That's where real contentment comes from. Contentment, you know, there are all kinds of methods out there, self-improvement methods and so forth. You take these 7 steps to become highly effective, or these 12 steps to get over problems in your life, or these 3 principles, or whatever it is. We're really great managers in our society, and we really want to manage our life. And we think if we just kind of hold to the program, things are going to come together for us. Well, there is a need for discipline, and I don't want to in any way disparage concrete things that we do to stay faithful to sobriety or morality or whatever. But there's something even deeper that is at stake here, and which is super important, and which is that we will never find contentment outside of a relationship with Christ. Everything else is just a substitute. Everything else is just trying for me to make something of my life that I can never generate on my own. Is something that has to come from God himself. Contentment, in other words, is an act of God's generosity toward us. Jesus puts it like this in John chapter 10. He says, I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. The purpose of God in your life is to give you a sense of fulfillment, of completion, a sense of being satisfied regardless of what circumstances you might find yourself in, because with Christ in your life, the key things that keep us discontent are answered. What are those things? The things that keep us discontent is our own internal awareness that we don't add up. The sense of unresolved conflict within, a sense of shame that we've perhaps carried for our lives, the recognition in our honest moments that there are real issues between me and God and that I cannot resolve those issues. Look, every human culture expresses just exactly that disconnect within. And that's why religion is a part of every human culture. It is humans' attempt to make ourselves acceptable to a God that we know that we're different from, that we have been alienated from. A couple of years ago, when we were in West Africa, we began meeting with village chiefs and talking about a belief that they had, which is just all over Western Africa, that there's a high God, a creator of heaven and earth, who brought all things into being, and then who just looked at the complicated nature of human society and said, I've had enough, I'm going away. And left to spirits that inhabit nature as the stewards of humanity. And so for all of historic memory in Western Africa, they're offering sacrifices of great value to stones and trees and soil and ancestors and so forth, in the desperate hope that somehow they could please spirits that were really completely indifferent to them so that they could get on with life. It's a culture of fear. And so when we began to talk about the God Most High, they had a category for that. They know what that meant. A God Most High who didn't just abandon humanity, but actually came in the person of Jesus Christ, not demanding sacrifice, but offering himself as a sacrifice for a guilty and alienated humanity. The offer of reconciliation through receiving the forgiveness that comes through the sacrifice of Christ. That message, my friends, is creating a revolution all over West and Central Africa today. It's amazing. It's that moment in time for that culture to realize all of our longings, all of our sense of disconnect with God are answered in the good news about Jesus Christ. There is an answer. You are here this morning sensing at the end of the day, you know, maybe I look at other people and I think I'm doing okay. I'm doing all right. At least I'm not like him. But inward, we know that we're just, you know, we're not right. That's a human comparison. And with God, we have deep insecurity. Let's resolve that insecurity even here this morning now just by turning to God and saying, look, I know that I'm far from you, but I do believe that you died on the cross for my sin and that you rose from the dead, demonstrating that you've resolved this problem that exists between me and you. And so I accept the gift of your forgiveness. And that begins a whole new thing. Now we've got the Spirit of God inside of us. We're reconciled to God. And that produces a certain sort of sense that the fight is over. We had a young lady in our home church a week ago Thursday. She'd come a couple of weeks, and it just became clear to her. She had that moment of clarity that we all have an opportunity to have, where this good news really kind of crashed in on her. And after the meeting was over, she grabbed her friend who brought her and said, "I want in. I want in." And so she's like, "Okay." And so they talked about what is the gospel, and she prayed and she received it. And as she was leaving, her friend said, "Kelsey, how do you feel?" She goes, "Bulletproof." It was kind of awesome. What she was describing is what Jesus says here. This abundance of life. This gift that no one can take away. That at the most root place in my life, I know that I'm okay with God. And everything else, frankly, is just pretty secondary after that. That's what abundant life is. Abundant life begins with this reconciliation with God through Christ. But then it unfolds in a life of abundance. Because why? Because with the Spirit of God within us, we have a capacity for real intimate connection at the most central place with other people, no matter who they are. In the body of Christ, Paul says in Galatians 3:28, there's neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female. We're all one in the body of Christ. And so we have this ability to connect with people, to establish fulfilling, significant love relationships, which no money could buy. A kind of contentfulness in our relationships, where we know that we are loved and are able to extend that love to other people. The world is trying to buy lovability and buy the affections of others, but deeply insecure that no matter what I do, it's just really not going to be quite good enough. The abundant life that God gives to us is this deep connection with Him and this deep connection with His people that has this satisfying and powerfully transforming effect on our lives. And Paul can end his letter with the Philippians just thanking God, rejoicing in Him, because he has this incredible bond with these people because they are united in the Spirit of God. They're reading off the same page, and the life of God just kind of comes to us in the context of those relationships with other people. So there's cause for joy. Praise God. He has not left us alone in our emptiness and in our guilt and in our shame. But He's come to us in Christ. Thank God. Rejoice in Him that He's provided for us a community to deal out the good things that God has for us, the deep bonds of relationship, the opportunity to live a life of real significance and outward focus that enables us to lose that sense of the burden of self so that we can care and find deep contentment in our relationships with others. So this is the letter of joy. Next week, we're going to come back and we're going to finish it up. And we're going to reflect on this deep statement by Paul in Philippians, but also throughout the Old Testament especially, that the joy of the Lord is my strength. So hopefully you come back and finish out our study.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.